Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Dr. Nicholas Baham III. On today's program, we'll be discussing what the corporate media is missing when it discusses recent international events regarding terrorism, the Paris Agreement, and the UN. Please stay with us.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Baham III. And later on, we'll be joined by our special announcer, Amy Casey. Again, we're broadcasting from California State University, East Bay in lovely Hayward, California. And I want to remind our listeners that we simply just record way too much content for the radio, and they can access more content by going to projectcensored.org/show, where you can get tons more content and learn how you can support the Project Censored Show. Amy, why don't you tell us what's going to be on the show today?
This is Amy Casey with the Media Freedom Foundation. Today's guest is Dr. Maria Ortuaste, an associate professor of political science at California State University, East Bay. Before we begin, a few reminders for our listeners. Please send us your feedback. We would love to hear your questions, comments, concerns, anything you want to share with us. You can send that feedback to projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. Now, in order to keep the show that we know you love on the air, we need some TLC and your support. Please go to projectcensored.org/show to learn how you can support the Project Censored Show.
All right, thank you very much, Amy. Dr. Ortuaste is actually in the studio with us. Usually we wait and have our guests, but I figured since you're here at the roundtable, if anything we say interests you, chime in. If it doesn't, you can just pretend like we're not here.
Okay.
Welcome to the show, though.
Hi. Thank you.
So one of the topics I want to talk about that we've continued, and Dr. Baham calls this our continued series on fascism, but I want to continue to document this rightward shift toward a fascist, not only a country, but planet that we're seeing as well. And I thought this was really exemplified with what happened in Portland, Oregon, which occurred since the last time we were all on the air together, where the president doesn't even address the attack on these two women and murder of these individuals who are trying to protect them. And it's become like this political issue. And I think this is really exemplifies when you've seen this drift toward fascism, when everything becomes politicized. I didn't know murder was a bipartisan issue. Like, I thought, generally speaking, we were against murder, regardless of who the victims are and the context in which it takes place. But I think that this really exemplifies that. It highlights another shift that we're not talking about. We have systematically in this country used terrorism to describe Arabs. Arabs have been the terrorists. Muslims have been the terrorists. But the real threat, at least here in the United States on the domestic front, has been these white right-wing Christian crusaders. And I'm not just saying this is some political propaganda or bipartisanship. This is from the Government Accountability Office, okay? Of the 85 violent extremist incidents since September 11, 2001, these far right-wing groups have been responsible for 73% of them. So you're far more likely in this country to be attacked by one of these white right-wing violent Christian crusader groups than you are by even an Arab or a Muslim or one of these supposed extremists. And this has been a trend that's continued over 15 years in this country. And so we talk about this a lot, but How do you get the word, or do you even think it's the right idea to get the word terrorism attached to these groups? How do we get them underneath the fold of what constitutes terrorism in this country? Nick, what do you think about that?
In understanding this, I think it's, first of all, important to understand that in the history of this country, the Ku Klux Klan was regarded as a religious organization and not as a terrorist organization. And for me, especially as a scholar in African-American black studies, This is where this sort of misunderstanding begins, where we look away from white nationalist terrorists who engaged in lynching and murder and call them a legitimate religious organization. But this is a fundamental principle of white supremacy in this country, that we look away from the murders, the riots, etc., of white people in this country. For example, even the term riot in and of itself, if you think about it, it immediately conjures the image of people of color tearing up their neighborhoods. When in fact, if one were to look at the American history in totality, most riots in this country were actually started by white people, and a number of them damaged communities of color. People who understand, for example, the riots that occurred around Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma, know this very much to be the case. In fact, Tulsa is the first example where aircraft were actually used to destroy a neighborhood, in this case, a black neighborhood in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
So as far as the discourse goes in this country, I think Deepa Kumar has done a phenomenal job on this in her book, Islamophobia, and there's been other scholars as well. It doesn't seem like this supposed war on terror has anything to do with safety, but they've been able to plant this false idea that there's like this evil cabal of Muslims and Arabs out there, and they're everywhere, and they're coming after all of us at all times, and we need to increase our military spending. We had a validated independent news story this week that there was $6.5 trillion in Pentagon spending allocated, and we have no trail as to where that money went. But if you put war on terrorism in front of it, everyone says, well, it's probably for the best, because there's this fear, but... I would argue the real fear is these white right-wing Christian groups, and none of that money is being allocated to combat these groups as far as we know.
But on the ground, one of the other phenomena that we're dealing with right now is that black people are buying guns in this country at record numbers.
You can see Bill O'Reilly freaking out right now when I said that.
Totally.
He scared him so
yeah,
bad.
Put him into a conniption fit. Yes. And, you know, this also happened, by the way, during the era of the Civil Rights Movement. One of the overlooked histories in the Civil Rights Movement were black gun clubs. People were arming them. So it wasn't just the Black Panther Party doing this. So there are people, there are segments of our population that are actually responding to the rise of white nationalism by arming themselves. The real key question here is, who's making money? So Smith & Wesson, Colt, whomever, Glock, they make money off of these things. So you ask, why do we tolerate this? Why don't we critique this at depth? It makes money. Whether we're talking about military contractors or companies who don't get military contracts, but then are able to sell military weapons to average citizens. Smith & Wesson probably doesn't really care whether black people are buying guns or whether white people are buying guns or whether Aryan Nation is buying guns or whether Muslims are buying guns. Guns are being bought, nor do they necessarily care who's dying. This is big business, and we're all sort of being, in my view, manipulated against one another in this regard as we ramp up an arms race within our streets and amongst the different sectors of our population.
And I'm glad you point that out, because I think this is a critical point here, right? A sign of this rising fascist state where you have this empowerment, this violence, this weapons that not only powers this piece of the public that feels like there's this fear, but also powers the corporate state that makes money off of selling these weapons.
That's correct.
And it allows, as we talked about a few weeks ago, about in this kind of post-truth America where there's no real facts, leadership can really step into that vacuum where facts used to exist and can kind of direct that anger wherever they choose. And I know we're going to end up talking later about what's going on in the Philippines, right? The supposed war on drugs.
That's right.
Which is used as really a cover for centralizing power in their fascist regime. But bringing it really quickly back home to here in the United States, what I think is unique is Trump stands in solidarity with these world leaders doing these things. And when these atrocities are committed here at home, he either does not comment or he justifies. I mean, he's not alone. Right-wing commentators have done this as well. A Fox News contributor actually called for internment camps on Fox News as a way to solve the problems of what he saw as the problems that were going on with Muslims and Arabs in America. We had a Democrat in the Texas House of Representatives protested that there were ICE raids being sent on peaceful protesters. The Republican said he wanted to put a bullet in his Democratic colleague's head.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of violent rhetoric has now taken over into our politics as well, where it's perfectly legitimate discourse to talk about locking people up in internment camps. I don't think I'm overstating this. The reason I think this has become legitimate discourse is because you think they would lose their jobs, right? Kathy Griffin holds up a bloody head of Trump, which isn't interesting at all, in my opinion, and probably got more press than it deserved. But she ends up losing her job. But this guy's talking about putting a bullet in a colleague's head, and he still has his job. This guy's in the air talking about locking people up in internment camps in what's supposedly a free country, although it never has been, but nonetheless. And this demonstrates, I think, that where we've shifted, this has become so normalized, this abuse of power.
Correct. Frankly, if I was in the House, I would have long ago applied for a concealed carry license. Does that contribute to normalizing things and getting past the madness? Absolutely not. It contributes to the madness. But if I had a colleague say that they would love to put a bullet in my head, why wouldn't I bother to show up with a concealed carry license or a bodyguard to the House of Representatives? I would certainly do that, right? But again, it just ramps up the violence. And then beyond that are, the corporate puppet masters who manipulate this kind of rhetoric and this fear, because fundamental to American politics is this fear impulse, right? You vote out of fear. We're taught, whether it's Democratic Party or Republican Party, we vote out of fear of something, right? And we arm ourselves out of fear, and we seclude ourselves in our specific enclaves, both ethnic and class, out of fear, and gate ourselves in out of fear. We live in a society of fear, and the people who make money off of that fear are very often hidden to us. We don't substantively critique them and the fact that they are making money off of this fear, nor do we actually, in our daily discourse with one another, seek to dismantle or deconstruct that sense of fear.
Yeah, and always, you know, there had been a concern with these democracies, right, that fear would turn into violence, right? And democracy is supposed to be a check on that violence. We'll somehow solve it in some organized, bureaucratic way. But that's why things like peaceful protests and stuff are used to move people instead of violence. But that always assumes that the peaceful protest is, one, going to be allowed, and two, going to be recognized by those in power. And we saw when the Turkish president Erdogan came to the United States, he was staying in D.C., and there were peaceful protests outside of his hotel where he was staying. And he sent out his henchmen on the street,
That's
and they
correct.
Started beating these peaceful protesters.
Correct.
This is in the United States. So this is not an overseas camera. This
and he was allowed
this.
To do that. There was no rebuke from the Trump administration.
No rebuke from the Trump. This should be an international crisis. Like this
Absolutely.
Should have been his way of getting himself out of America's good graces. But instead, it's completely silent and been accepted. And so I'm sure we'll talk about these issues and more when we get to our guest here. You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Baham, Third, and we will be back after this short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Baham III. And we are talking about fascism.
Yes, and today we're pleased to have Dr. Maria Ortuoste in studio with us. Dr. Ortuoste is currently an associate professor of political science at California State University's Bay. Dr. Ortuoste has 20 years of research experience in both government and academic settings. She has around 10 years of policy experience with the Center for International Relations and Strategic Studies, the research arm of the Philippines Foreign Service Institute. In that capacity, she wrote strategic studies and policy papers on Philippine foreign policy in the Association of Southeast Asian Nations and the United Nations, as well as papers on specific issues such as the South China Sea, peacekeeping, proliferation of conventional arms and nuclear weapons, U.S. alliance systems, and human rights. In the academic field, Dr. Ortuoste has published several articles on the nexus of domestic and regional institutions in Southeast Asia, democratization and human rights, Timor-Leste, the South China Sea, and the impact of social media on governance. She finished her PhD from Arizona State University and her BA and MA degrees from the University of the Philippines. Welcome, Dr. Ortuoste.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thanks.
So we want to talk a little bit, focus our discussion with you on the Philippines and what we've characterized as the rise of fascism, and maybe you could give us some context on that and if that's a correct characterization. First, if we could begin with you giving us a sense of who Rodrigo Duterte is, his background, etc. I'm aware that he comes from a provincial political dynasty, and then his father, Vicente, was related to Ramon Durano, a notorious warlord in the central province of Cebu, and that also Vicente served on the cabinet during the Marcos regime.
Yeah, you're correct. So Duterte is, a lot of people portray him as being outside of politics. But the thing is that he is as much a product of the political system of the Philippines, but his approach is different. It's all unique, let's just say that. And you're right that he is a lawyer. He graduated from the number 3 law school in the Philippines. His father was the leader of the province before, and he himself has served for a very long time as mayor of Davao. And now he usually rotates that position with his daughter or his son.
Yes. Yes, yeah. His daughter, Sarah, and his son, Paulo, who's currently vice mayor, is that correct, of Davao?
Yes.
And I understand that his younger brother, Benjamin, has served as a city councilman as well.
Right. He also served as prosecutor, and he was also in Congress briefly, where he said he was kind of bored.
So he's a real political insider.
He is a political insider. And it's just that he is not one of those in the older political dynasties.
I see.
Like the older landed mestizo elites, political elites. He's more local. And that's another important, can I mention that?
Yes.
The local side of it, because in the Philippines and in other places where, you know, patronage or patron-client relations are still relied upon, having local networks, local alliances, or alliances between the national government and the local politicians is important to deliver the votes. So he is a part of that local alliance, but he eventually rose to power and attracted a lot of attention because of his tough talk and his promise to change, and which is kind of interesting because the previous president, Benigno Aquino III, he also promised change, but that was more of a liberal, neoliberal bent. And whereas Duterte is more, like you said, populist. But he's not really, he's populist, but at the same time, he still adheres to neoliberal economics. Does that make
sense?
Yeah.
Because I noticed that in thinking about him, that there are significant links both to the Marcos regime and Aquino. My understanding is that his rise to power was actually, it actually happened during the Aquino administration, at which point in time it was suggested that his mother run for office, but then his mother deferred actually to him.
Yeah, so it's kind of weird. His mother was actively supporting Corazon Aquino. She was active in non-government organizations, whereas his father had a little different political leaning. That was one of the reasons why he also entered politics as well. Like I said, from the national government, Corazon Aquino, to the local, mm-hmm. his mother, that was the connection there. And he has a lot of dealings with communists and dealings with the Muslim groups too. So.
You are listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon, and we are talking to Dr. Ortuatse, a professor of political science at California State University, East Bay. And we are talking about politics in the Philippines right now. And I wonder, people have made this comparison to contemporary U.S. politics with what's going on in the Philippines. And I don't want to shift this conversation too much to the U.S., but I'm curious as to if you were speaking to a U.S. audience, how these two administrations would compare as far as the rhetoric that was given, like the bellicose rhetoric on the trail, mm-hmm. and then the actual practice once in office.
Yeah, I was asked that before somewhere, and there are a lot of similarities between Trump and Duterte. Both of them provide policy pronouncements with very little substance. The key thing here to know is that Duterte has had a lot of political experience.
Unlike Trump.
So okay. He knows the system. He's a lawyer. Mm-hmm. He has a network of lawyers that are his friends who are put into certain positions. He is allegedly, and I say allegedly, supported death squads in Davao.
Correct.
To clean up the town. So he is more ready and more willing to use those instruments of power. And the difference is that those instruments of power, those institutions, are more malleable than they are here in the U.S.
You're talking about specifically the DDS, the Davao Death Squad.
Yes.
I was reading about how these guys you'd put two men on a motorcycle, they would ride up to a target, shoot them with a handgun, speed off, leave the body in the streets to mark out what they were doing. What was because my understanding is that after it was disbanded, I read that there was a poll of citizens, some of whom said that they wished that the DDS would come back.
How do you want me to answer that? why they want them to come back, and
what was really sort of the mission or the goal of the Davao Death Squad that Duterte created as mayor?
Right. Can I give a little background?
Sure.
The situation in Mindanao, if for people who don't know about Mindanao is the second largest island group in the Philippines, and it's also the poorest region. Okay, it's predominantly Muslim, although the Philippines is 90% Christian. And the people of Mindanao have had a very bad relationship with the national government, as with many other countries. So they feel neglected, and rightly so. People were sent over there to take over their land, which they're sold. But now you have the difference is now you also have a lot of Christians there who call Mindanao their home. And they also feel neglected, both Christians and Muslims. His rise to power is also premised on going against Imperial Manila, because that's how they see the central government. We just got rid of the other colonizers. Here's the new one, mm-hmm. from the central government. And in that area, during the 60s, 70s, there were communist guerrillas. So they were there in Mindanao as well. At the same time, you have the separatist groups in Mindanao as well. So you have the communists and the Muslim separatists. It's like we also need to be in some way sympathetic to ordinary people, because they're caught in between these two groups. And it was really a very difficult existence. For example, I have in-laws who lived there in Cotabato City, and bombs going off is kind of par for the course. People are firing guns. They can identify what a gun type is by the sound.
Wow.
So, fully
normalized.
Yeah, and in Davao, there's a lot of extortion, and this is sad, extortion by the communists. I'm not sure with the Muslim separatists, I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure also that there are extortions from local police. Mm-hmm. So, everybody's victimizing them. In some way, they really, really want that law and order. Mm-hmm. And it's gotten, I guess, sometimes to a point where some people feel like it's okay to give up your freedoms, mm-hmm. in exchange for some law and order. I don't necessarily agree with that, but that's how people feel. And the challenge now is, how do you do that when your institutions are bad? Mm-hmm. When the police system is corrupt, and when it, not all justices are corrupt, but where justices might be influenced by certain things. It's that kind of situation. And he came in and restored order in that sense. And yes, there were death squads. Like I said, I don't agree with death squads or murder.
Right.
But that was the kind of, I think, desperation that people felt.
Mm-hmm. So tell our listeners then, you talked about this, and this is an age-old debate about between security and liberty, right? Mm-hmm. This back and forth. In the history of the Philippines, what has been that relationship? Strongmen, leaders who maintain order? Has it been more decentralized power? What's sort of the history? Does he fit into a historical trend, or is he abnormal for the history of the Philippines?
No, there was this scholar in Southeast Asia, Walters, and he talked about a man of prowess in Southeast Asia, someone with soul spirit. And in a lot of ways, personality matters in the Philippines. And it has fluctuated. It goes back and forth. You have Ferdinand Marcos. He was a strongman. And then after him, you have Corazon Aquino, who was female figure, the widow of this political opponent who was assassinated. And then after her, it was Fidel V. Ramos, a former general. So another strongman. But he reined in. Everyone was afraid that he would declare martial law, but he didn't. I'm sure there were a host of other problems with his administration too. But so you had him, and then we transitioned to a populist, Joseph Estrada, who was also an actor.
Really fascinating.
Very populist, but pro-poor.
Right.
So he says all of these. And then he was ousted because of corruption, took over by Macapagal Arroyo, another woman who was educated here in the U.S., etc.
Yes.
So it's seesaws, I guess. Mm-hmm. And in some way, I look at it now as like a country or a political system trying to find its balance. Because at the same time that you have Duterte, who was elected as president, he received like 16 million votes. And since we're on plurality system, mm-hmm. that's only 39%
right,
of the votes.
Right, okay? Very similar to Trump's electoral mm-hmm. victory, yes.
But he won. In the Philippines, it's a very different system. The vice president is elected separately. Mm-hmm. So our vice president is from a different party. And she's Leni Robredo, who is the widow, this human rights lawyer, and she is also herself a human rights activist. Mm. So, and she won by 14 million votes. So do you see the strange thing is, we have 15.9 million for Duterte, but 14 million for Leni Robredo, who's a human rights advocate.
That's fascinating.
Right.
I wonder, you know, Dr. Otuaste, the degree to which we in the United States, U.S. imperialism, has created Duterte in the sense that how far back should we go here? Should we start thinking about McKinley's benevolent assimilation, the betrayal of the Philippines under Roosevelt, this notion that we were there to liberate them from the Spanish, but then actually, well, maybe not, we're there to colonize them. Is the United States, and specifically is U.S. imperialism, to blame for this sort of seesaw legacy, and in particular for the rise of these right-wing populist leaders?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Well, first of all, I'll give you my philosophy. It's like there are certain things, legacies that persist. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there's still freedom of choice.
Right.
There's agency. In a lot of ways, the system, political system, which was kind of set up by the Spaniards, which corrupted patronage, and the Americans, when the Americans introduced this democratic system, they relied on local networks to deliver the votes. Mm-hmm. So that's part of it. And then another part of it, in terms of dictators, it doesn't matter I think the saying was, it doesn't matter if the guy is an SOB as long as he is our SOB.
Right.
Right. And Marcos fit that bill. In some way, yes. At the same time, I think, like I was saying, there's this real need for people for some direction. Mm-hmm. Like it or not, even though the previous administration, there was great economic growth, there was They did a lot in terms of foreign policy. There were a lot of things that they neglected, and it didn't institutionalize the reforms.
Okay, you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Bam III, and we are talking to Dr. Maria Ortuwatsde, and she will be back after this short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Bayham III, and we have the privilege of talking to Dr. Maria Ortuwatsde. She is a professor of political science at California State University, East Bay in Hayward, California.
Dr. Ortuwatsde, I really appreciate your characterization of the influence of U.S. imperialism on the history of politics in the Philippines, particularly since 1986. But it does seem that Duterte is kind of manipulating this notion of American colonial influence. And I note in particular a discussion that he had with President Obama, where he showed Obama photographs of Muslims who had been killed by U.S. soldiers in the Philippines in the early 20th century. And his quote was, "This is human rights. Do not tell me this is water under the bridge. A human rights violation, whether committed by Moses or Abraham, is still a violation of human rights."
I think so. In some way, I think there are still Filipinos who are, and I don't know like how much like in terms of percentage, but there is this sense of, let me go back, after the U.S. purchased the Philippines from the Spanish, there was 12 to 15 year war. Philippine-American War, but that has never been really acknowledged by the U.S., and it's just termed as an insurgency. But there were a lot of people who were killed, and especially in Mindanao.
So I think some scholars refer to it as a genocide, not a war.
There you go. And it actually, the Spanish were never able to, well, they tried to, but they were never able really to bring Mindanao into the orbit of the Philippine central government. It was Americans who did that. So in a lot of ways, yes. And then you have all of these plantations in the Philippines, Del Monte, Dole. We have great pineapples.
Do you work for the Bureau of Travel over there?
No. But it touches on that nerve.
I see.
Now, whether or not, how strong that is still, I don't know. Because it's been such a long time.
Correct.
And when you look at some of the, I was looking at some of the recent polls. For example, the first quarter survey of the social weather stations, a first quarter for 2017, it looks at the net trust rating for countries.
Yes.
The U.S. is still number one.
Wow. Yeah.
Okay, so we have this kind of love-hate relationship where we like the pop culture. Mm-hmm. Almost everybody speaks English. You like them here. But there is that the side where it is very interventionary. And Duterte has had links with the communist guerrillas in some way. I guess not necessarily with them, but he has some sympathy for this in terms of possibly some ideology.
I see.
One of the things we constantly talk about here on the Project Censored Show is we talk about how in starting in the 70s, a lot of our foreign news bureaus started cutting costs, and so we lost a lot of journalists overseas. And at the same time, the American military is dramatically expanding around the world. Americans know less and less about the nations that we're bombing or invading. And so I wondered, with your vast knowledge of the Philippines here, what are some things about the contemporary context of Philippines, maybe politics or social existence, that you think would be important for Americans to know, kind of make judgments about our government's relations with the Philippines?
Can you be more specific?
true. Well, yeah, I mean, what do you think, like, the average American voter should know about the Philippines that maybe they don't, that's not really said, explained widespread on media?
Well, there are a lot of expats, American expats in the Philippines, opening businesses, actually. That's one thing maybe to know, which might be interesting in terms of the kinds of relationship the U.S. has with the Philippines. This is ironic. For all the rhetoric against Americans, there are U.S. military advisors, quote unquote, in Mindanao for counterterrorism. Not a lot of people know that, I think, right? So, and that's very important because this war on terrorism has not been over. It's been going on and on. And apart from that, Mindanao is also a good place for the U.S. to have presence in terms of monitoring the activities of China. And the U.S. had actually funded these monitoring stations to help the Philippines with maritime domain awareness. Those are some of the things that they're doing.
That's so interesting, because it makes the statements that Duterte has made about moving away from the relationship with the United States closer towards a relationship with China all the more interesting. And I take it that you would interpret those as more bluster than reality.
Yes. It's kind of difficult to figure that out, because you have to separate Duterte from the bureaucracy sometimes. And the Philippine military is very close to the United States, a military. Okay, they wouldn't want U.S. military assistance or aid to end.
I see.
And also there were rumors. Here's the other thing I would want to say about fascism. It engenders a lot of rumors and conspiracy theories.
Yes.
Okay. So mainly because of disinformation or lack of information. So all of these, sorry to digress.
Earlier you had brought up the Philippines being the strategic location for the U.S., and you were talking about in relation to China. And I actually had that sort of down as one of my questions about that maybe Americans should know. There's always this sort of looming conspiracy about the great China threat that Americans fear, that's sort of spread through our media. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about, well, first, the legitimacy of that supposed China threat, but also the importance of the Philippines as a player in that relationship.
Okay. Separate Duterte from the military and the foreign affairs bureaucracy. And all of them have strong ties with the U.S. And those are things you cannot just pull out from. And this kind of goes to your question now, because in terms of external defense, and this is really weird, Philippines is an archipelago, but it has one of the worst navies in Southeast Asia, mainly because it had relied on the United States for external security when they had their permanent military base there. And in exchange, the local military were supposed to take care of the communist insurgency inside the Philippines. See the trade-off there?
Yes.
In terms of China as a threat, I think China's approach has changed a lot. And in the beginning, it had a charm of offensive. So just being nice to everyone, etc. But then I think many Southeast Asians feel betrayed by what China has done, which is to not get out of islands, to delay the negotiations on a binding code of conduct in the South China Sea. They have harassed Philippine Coast Guard, Philippine fishers. So in a lot of ways, it's kind of true for the countries around China, mainly because China is a big guy. Whether or not it's a direct threat to the United States, an existential threat to the United States, I don't know. I don't think so. But in the sense that if China threatens Japan or South Korea, and that the U.S. has mutual defense treaties with Japan and South Korea, then that's a problem. So China, in that sense, I won't say not necessarily threat, but it's problematic in terms of the kinds of regional security dynamics it could unleash, where now you have Japan, which has revised its laws in terms of self-defense. So, which is worrying China. But then you have North Korea, which China is trying to control or unable to control, or they say unable to control, threatening Japan and South Korea. The problem there is whether the U.S. will be dragged into a conflict.
That's interesting, because one of the or fears we always hear. China has this miracle economy and its people are living high and there's this industrialization. But tell me if I'm wrong, but I think scholars disagree, right? Isn't there some mass poverty problem in China?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of people who've been displaced. There's growing inequality. And what they're worried about is really the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party. And the Chinese Communist Party is only communist in name now, because it is, you know, a free market. A free market where you can grease some wheels, right?
Absolutely.
to get going. The challenge, if communism as an ideology is gone in China, so what else do you have? So they've turned to first nationalism, which is why some people, some scholars argue that that's why there's this push towards claiming all of these islands and waters in the South China Sea as a way for the people to have loyalty to the national government. So one is nationalism, and the other is they have to ensure continued economic growth.
Dr. Ortuoste, we certainly can't let you out of here before we talk about Abu Sayyaf. My understanding is that, first of all, sort of curious about the story of how Duterte managed to secure the release of a Norwegian hostage who had been kidnapped by them. And I'm also curious, I know it's a small organization of maybe only about 400 plus people, but if you have any sense of how many members of Abu Sayyaf have actually been killed by Duterte's administration and are in that group of 3,000 and counting that have been murdered in the Philippines. Please, yes, because we really need to understand the sophistication of that.
So there are, well, the original secessionist group is the Mora National Liberation Front, MNLF. And they were fighting since the 70s, and eventually they reached an agreement in the late 80s, 90s with the government.
Okay.
They had an autonomous region, etc. But only a few provinces voted for it. Most of Mindanao was still not autonomous. But a group, the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, broke away from the Moro National Liberation Front. They were the more serious problem going up to the 2000s. The previous administration reached some agreement with them, and they're trying to finalize their plan for the region. So again, from MILF, there was a breakaway group, which they call the BIFF.
Mm-hmm.
And Abu Sayyaf was actually kind of contemporaneous to MILF, but they also separated from them. And the Abu Sayyaf, unlike the MILF and the MNLF, who at least were willing to negotiate, the Abu Sayyaf has always been seen as extremist and a bunch of criminals, because that's all they're doing, extorting money and kidnapping people. So that's the difference. And if you're talking about the recent one, the recent reason for declaring martial law, that's different from the Abu Sayyaf. It's a Maute group, which is, the Mautes are a political clan there who've been agitating also for their own independence and has claimed that their allegiance to ISIS. Just wanted to give the context. There's
appreciate that.
Abu
Thank
Sayyaf,
you.
Yeah, it is a smaller one, but it's a more deadly. And why are they able to go around? If you look at the map of the Philippines and Mindanao, there are a lot of waterways. And it's very easy to elude the Navy and Coast Guard, especially when at some point in time they had better equipment than the Coast Guard. Okay, so... And also, there's you hide behind families, etc. Like it or not, whether willingly or unwillingly, if you're a local and a rebel group asks you, "Can you hide me, or I'll kill you and your family?" Obviously, you will hide them.
Right.
Right. So, in a lot of ways, that's one of the reasons they're able to persist, and it doesn't help with policies of the government as well. That was the background there.
This has been a fascinating interview. Like I said, it's really important to have someone like yourself with your knowledge of foreign affairs, because we miss a lot of that in the American press. So it's been a pleasure to have you. So I know we only have a couple more minutes, so I have some just giant topics, but I want to kind of throw them at you as a point of discussion. There's a lot of panic and fear about international politics right now. I think part of that, again, comes from an ignorance about them. We see what are these perceived threats by neoliberalism and fascist regimes and perhaps threats to the existence of the UN, and we see things like Brexit. Can you kind of tell our listeners, have we ever been sort of at a point in human history where we've seen institutions challenge like this? Or is this, you know, something abnormal, something different than we could possibly compare to in the past?
I think this is something very different right now, because if history, if I remember history well, the one challenge to international organizations then was when the United States left the League of Nations, which then helped precipitate World War II. Well, that didn't help precipitate it, but it was one of the reasons why. In terms of now, all of these institutions that you're talking about are very well established and formalized and institutionalized, unlike the League of Nations back in the day. So this is very different, although there were challenges to the EU and the European community when they were forming. There were a lot of challenges from the countries there. Like you said, this time it's different. And what is concerning is it seems like the rise of nationalism and populism and, well, not necessarily populism, a nationalism that is very anti-foreign. But it's more rabid, I guess, is what I would say. People, it seems that a lot more people are hurting from, a lot of ordinary people are hurting and feeling the effects of inequality, poverty.
So do you stop short of using the term to a fascism to apply to leaders like Trump or Duterte or Erdogan and the Turkey? Do you stop short of using that term? Do you think it's accurate? Do you think it's an overstatement? And if so, why?
They might be. I guess I just try to be careful when I mm-hmm. when I use terms. I would say that they're on their way. Mm-hmm. So some way ahead more than others. They might have this authoritarian personality, but if you have domestic political institutions that are stronger than the personalities, then it could be countered by those institutions. But I would agree with you that these leaders have a very authoritarian tendencies, and they're able to act on them. Whereas at least Trump in the United States, you have, even though he has a majority in Congress and in Senate, there is something that's trying to challenge him mm-hmm. and prevent him from taking over the media, for example.
How close is Duterte? I note that he's been asked about his longevity, and like Trump, he is 70, 71 years of age, and has made mention of the fact that he may not actually live much longer, either because he's going to die in office or someone will at some point in time assassinate him. He seems to be somewhat realistic that he is part of a culture of violence within the Philippines and may die as a result of that culture of violence. But up to this point, how far away, in your view, is Duterte from what we would call being a fascist, a full-blown fascist, and the Philippines from slipping into a full-blown fascist state?
The person himself, maybe if it's a range from 1 to 10, I would say a 7.
Okay.
In terms of the Philippines political system moving into fascism, maybe around between 6 to 8. And part of the reason for that is mainly because of the political popularity of Duterte.
I see.
And the support that he still gets, even though recent surveys are concerned about these extrajudicial killings and
Correct.
A lot of people are concerned that they might be the next targets, his popularity is still really high.
Yeah, well, it's about 89%, right? Approval, something like that. I mean, that is a difference, frankly, from Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
His approval is on the rise.
Yes, the net satisfaction rating for the first quarter of 2017, according to one of the polls, is that 75% were satisfied. Satisfaction rating is plus 66.
That's unprecedented.
And you can't even, it's such a difference, because you can't even get like 89 or even 66%
That's
Americans
correct.
To agree on anything in this
That's
country
correct.
Anymore.
That's
agree,
correct.
Yeah.
I mean, we think about it favorably when a president has anything over 50, frankly, in terms of approval.
And I think it goes to your question earlier, why Trump seems to admire Duterte. It's his popularity, and that he seems to be able to get away with a lot of things.
It's probably a good call.
They can
Jealousy.
Make, yeah, they can make jokes.
They also share a deep profound hatred of the press, too.
But they were able to use the social media to their advantage very, very well. And there was this one analysis about how they used bots and paid trolls for their campaigns.
Well, listen, it's been just very interesting talking to you, and I hope you come back on the Project Censored show, because this has been great.
Right. So you've really helped to inaugurate our series on the rise of fascism in the world.
I hope it doesn't end your
series. Hopefully it's short-lived.
No. All right. We're going to move on.
Thanks a lot for coming on the Project Censored show. We appreciate it. All right, we'll be back after this short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon, in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Bayham III. And as you all know, we here at the Media Freedom Foundation produce tons of content that illuminates the work of fact-based journalists, as well as presents alternative narratives to the corporate press. And our special announcer, Amy Casey, is here to tell us about those.
This is Amy Casey again of the Media Freedom Foundation with just some of the stories that we are working on. At the Global Critical Media Literacies webpage, gcml.org, Dr. Rob Williams, the co-president of the Action Coalition for Media Education, and his student, Shannon Cowley, University of Vermont, have published #SM, My Strange Addiction. The article examines the increasingly dangerous addiction to social media, including the five traits that drive the addiction for people of all ages, but especially children and young adults. Also at gcml.org, #Evolution, A Decade of the Pound Symbol on Twitter. This article, also written by Dr. Rob Williams with his student Abby Schuster at the University of Vermont, documents the indoctrination of the hashtag that has permeated the very fabric of our culture in a multitude of ways. From Citrus College, Project Censored Associate Director Andy Lee Roth and his student Paul McPherson have nominated an independent validated news story that is a story covered by the independent press yet ignored by the corporate press, titled A Bottomless Barrel, California's Big Oil Boom. The story covers the relationship between California legislation and big oil, which promotes a romanticized climate change champion image, despite utilizing dangerous extraction methods. That can be found at projectcensored.org. In another validated independent news story, also from Citrus College, Project Censored Associate Director Andy Lee Roth and his students, Cynthia Alvarez, Veronica Esquivez, and William Ha, published Inmates and Activists Protest Use of Chemical Weapons in U.S. Prisons and Jails. The story covers the use of chemical weapons against U.S. prisoners, noting the monetary benefit for the companies that manufacture them. That is available at projectcensored.org. One more validated independent news story, again from Citrus College, and Project Censored Associate Director Andy Lee Roth and his student Hugo Souza, published 2016, The Year of Internet Shutdowns. The story illustrates the connection between government-controlled internet blackouts with freedom of speech limitations, swayed elections, damaged economies, and human rights violations. That can be found at projectcensored.org. At this time, I would like to remind our listeners to go to projectcensored.org/show. There you can access free content and show your support for Project Censored. I'm Amy Casey, and that is the news that did not make the news.
Thank you very much, Amy. Always a pleasure. And thank you very much for listening. And again, if you guys have any feedback, please send us an email at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. I love hearing from you. We like reading your stuff on the air. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Bayham III. Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips are executive producers and hosts. Our intern special announcer is Amy Casey, and Mitch Scores is our engineer. The Project Censored Show airs on nearly 40 stations around the United States. Please follow us and like us on Facebook. Send us an email at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com and visit our website online at projectcensored.org, where you can find the archives of all of our past shows for over 6 years, as well as 40 years of news that didn't make the news. Thanks for joining us. See you next time. Cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won. We got the love of the thought brothers. Crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguised under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons filled with capacity citizens. In the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.